Texas. It is Tuesday, April 1, and Rosie will not be fooled today. Public hearing on House Bill 5030, Department of Human Services, Health Services. We will continue where we left off yesterday, and we left off with Vicki Nakashima with the Office of Multicultural Health. And I was just sharing, Vicki, welcome. For some of you who do not know, I knew Vicki in her much younger days. Much younger days, she and I, with Model Cities, which was on quite a few years ago, Vicki, I think back in 1968. You sure, somewhere around in there? And we both came from Portland to Salem. So welcome, and it's good seeing you again. And you can continue with your with talking about the multicultural health.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to come back, and I will be very brief. I wanted to, when I left yesterday, we discussed a little the four strategies that the Office of Multicultural Health and the Governor's Task Force on Racial and Ethnic Health have used to address the work of the Office of Multicultural Health. And those areas are increasing the availability of data on racial and ethnic populations, cultural competency of the existing health system, the workforce that deals with delivering the services, and finally, access to health care and health services. I wanted to point out one example and then leave a document for the committee to, given yesterday's discussion about health disparities. The document I'm going to leave is titled Unequal Treatment, Confronting Racial and Ethnic Disparities in Healthcare. And it's the Institute of Management's Institute of Medicine, National Academy of Sciences report on health disparities. And I think it points out it points out very clearly that discrimination and disparities in healthcare affect people of color regardless of access to health insurance or services, and removing those variables, there are still differences in outcomes, and I felt that would be useful. What I'd like to do very quickly is give you one example that we're working on that I think illustrates how we address health disparities in the area of workforce. We were able this biennium to receive $30,000 from the Office of Minority Health to explore bringing in more bilingual bicultural nurses. And we were able to form a partnership that includes Salem Hospital, McMinnville Hospital, Silverton, Kaiser Permanente Clinics, and the Oregon State Hospital. And what those institutions have identified is the need for larger numbers of bilingual bicultural nurses. As we know today, there are fewer than 2% of all the nurses who are identified as Hispanic, and that in many areas of the state, we've been told that there are few or no bilingual bicultural nurses to serve an ever-growing bilingual constituency within those communities. This partnership has resulted in acquiring additional money for 12 bilingual employees who are high-performing and identified by those employers as existing employees with great potential to go into nursing, who are exposed to the work through their positions. And they are now going through a nursing prerequisite program and will soon complete that program and go into an RN training program. Now, that partnership includes the Office of Minority Health, but also the 6 clinics and hospitals in the Salem metropolitan area. I did want to point out that this project is designed to be, the students are students who would not normally go into nursing without the opportunity. They have to meet all of the standards of Chemeketa Community College's nursing program, but they do not need to compete with the pool of students who are competing to enter their program, because we are funding that through an employer-sponsored training program. So we are able to control student enrollment, and they're able to go through as a cohort group. That group, hopefully in about 18 months from now, will complete a two-year RN program, and they will greatly increase the number of bilingual bicultural nurses in the 5-6 employer partnership that we're administering this program. I wanted to give you that as an example because it's looking at ways to partner with other organizations in the community to meet a need where clearly without additional people with the skills and cultural background of the people who are underrepresented, we would not be able to address health disparities in our communities. With that, I will close, and if there are any questions or any opportunities, I did bring additional copies of the Governor's Task Force report, and I will leave copies of the Institute of Medicine's report for your reference.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Senator Gordon?
Madam Chair, thank you. My apologies to you, Vicki, for being unavoidably detained and missing a part of your presentation. But I did want to take this opportunity just to acknowledge your outstanding leadership in the Office of Multicultural Health, leadership that has moved the state forward, leadership that has supported the work of the Governor's Racial and Ethnic Health Task Force, and to also share it with you, Madam Chair, and other members of our committee that our new Governor Kulongoski has also committed to putting in place a new executive order that will allow the work of the Racial and Ethnic Health Task Force to go forward. But again, I didn't want to miss an opportunity just to underscore and make a statement about the quality of leadership that Vicki Nakashima has brought to the office because it has been outstanding.
Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, I appreciate the remarks, and I think it's a labor of love for all of us, and without Senator Gordley's leadership, we would not have a task force. So thanks.
And I need to announce that the House is tardy because they got out late today, and one of the things as we go through the session, I know there will be times when members cannot show up at 1. But if when we're doing the overviews, unless we, in work session, we need to have a majority. But other than that, I will go ahead and proceed because I know that we're having lengthy discussions, and I want to make sure that everybody has the opportunity to testify and also that the agencies don't feel pushed. So with that,
thank you, Madam Chair.
Barry Cass.
I will be extraordinarily brief. We're going to change the orders a bit. Dr. Mel Cohn, who's joined me at the table, will make the initial presentation on disease prevention and chronic disease management. And then I think Mike Skeels from the Public Health Laboratories will be here to talk about some issues with the lab that are related and extremely important in connection with Mel's presentation. And let me just say, I've learned a great deal from Dr. Cohn, but the thing that I really have learned, the bottom line, is wash your hands. He told me to wash. If you go to the zoo and you pet an animal, wash your hands. It's very important. Just like
Barry,
my mom
if
said.
If you worked in restaurants, you would know that that is the number one instruction of training. I can recall a couple of sessions ago, there was some questions about training young people, and I can remember talking to one of our my fellow colleagues, in fact, it was Reverend Gardner, and he was saying, well, you know, it's really easy. And I said, do you realize how much time it takes us to train young people how to wash their hands so that they don't contaminate the public? So washing their hands is very critical. Did I give your pitch for you, Doctor?
I did. This is Mel.
Madam
Cole,
Chair, absolutely. State
epidemiologist.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon, and thank you for that pitch. That's perfect introduction, and I guess I can feel that I've succeeded if I've taught you that, Barry. That's really very wonderful. I'm going to be talking about the Office of Disease Prevention and Epidemiology, which is my unit within DHS Health Services, and some of you may be wondering what on earth an epidemiologist is. And I'm the state epidemiologist. An epidemiologist, if you break down the word, is somebody who studies the pattern and spread of diseases, epidemi like epidemics, and ology like the study of. And we use this information to design and evaluate and refine our prevention programs to prevent disease, disability, and illness, other kinds of illness. Our office is also very much focused on many of the data issues that Barry referred to yesterday as being really part of the foundation of all of the work that we do in public health. The primary ways that we collect data are through what we call public health surveillance, which is the ongoing tracking and monitoring, the radar screen, if you will, of what are the health problems that ought to be of concern to us here in Oregon. And also through some additional kinds of more in-depth studies that try to gather additional information, again, that we can use to develop and refine our prevention programs, help us target our resources appropriately. Our office has primarily seven programs, and we can be grouped. Those can be grouped together on page 419, 4-19. They're listed here. First is acute and communicable disease prevention, which not surprisingly deals with acute and communicable diseases, primarily outbreaks and the kinds of things that I think most people think of when they think about public health. Injury prevention and epidemiology. Injury is the leading cause of death and disability for children in particular. I know that's an issue, the health of children, that's of great concern to the committee and to the governor as well. I wanted to point that out. Environmental and occupational epidemiology. This refers to things like environmental exposures, toxic exposures, and so forth. Oh, boy, I'm really going to have to pay Rosie for this one. HIV, sexually transmitted diseases, and tuberculosis program. The reason those three are grouped together is that, of course, HIV is a sexually transmitted disease primarily, and also many of the folks who get HIV are at very high risk for TB and have played a very unfortunate role in the resurgence of the tuberculosis epidemic in this country, sort of together with the HIV epidemic. So those programs are grouped together. Health statistics and vital records, that's the group that does things like birth certificates, death certificates, and so forth. And that is the only group among these that is supported primarily with fees that are generated from the production of those certificates, which are legal records. Health promotion and chronic disease prevention, which encompasses a variety of programs. I'm going to talk about some of those in a minute. And then program design and evaluation services, which is a unit that helps us look at our programs and try to figure out what's working, what isn't working, and how can we improve what we're doing. Now, we do a lot of work at the state level, but of course, as Barry alluded to yesterday, much of the hands-on work, really the frontline work, goes on at our county health departments, and they are extraordinarily important for us to get done what we need to get done, particularly in the area of communicable disease control. So I wanted to make sure that I mentioned that. In addition to collecting these data and using them to develop and run public health programs, I also wanted to stress to all of you that we think that one of the roles that we try very hard to play is as a source of information for you all, for policymakers like you who need good information in order to craft good policy. So please, I know several members of the committee at various times have called on us for information, and please, I want to stress that we're happy to fulfill that role, and if there's anything that you need, please don't hesitate to ask, and we'll do our best to supply it for you if we have it. Now what I'd like to do is, having kind of presented the overview of what we do, is concentrate on a few specific programs that we have, I think, to illustrate how we do what we do. So the first program I'd like to talk about is our tobacco prevention and education program. In 1996, the voters voted in a tobacco tax, 10% of which was, according to the ballot measure, to be dedicated to tobacco control in Oregon. And it's these funds that primarily have been used to run our tobacco prevention and education program since its inception. The program actually didn't start until 97. And since that time, I think we've had some very impressive results. But first let me say that tobacco is an enormous health problem. In fact, it is the leading preventable cause of death and disability, not only in Oregon, but throughout the United States. It's estimated that about 6,000 Oregonians die every year from tobacco-related diseases. That comes out to about 18 Oregonians every day dying from tobacco. So this is a very, very serious health problem, even with the successes that we've had with our program. Since 1996, when ballot measure 44 was voted in, we've had about a 30% decline.
Do you have the statistics that give the average age of the 6,000 annual death?
Madam Chair, off the top of my head, I can't tell that to you, but I'll be happy to take that back and try to get that information for you. Many of the diseases that tobacco causes, of course, are things that tend to occur among older folks, things like cancer, which has a fairly long latency period. But the heart disease deaths in particular tend to occur among younger people. And actually, those are the very same deaths that are prevented when you stop smoking most rapidly. Your risk falls pretty dramatically in the first few years if you stop smoking.
What percentage of them are emphysema and some of those other maladies?
Madam Chair, off the top of my head, I can't tell you that, but I will be happy to get that for you. I will do that.
Thank you.
I am indeed.
Thank you. The chart on page 421 documents the fall in per capita cigarette sales that we've seen here in Oregon. The dotted line on the top shows the drop that's happened nationwide. There are a few states that are pulled out of that nationwide number because they also have comprehensive tobacco control programs. But you can see the Oregon line underneath really is falling at about twice the rate of what's been seen nationally. And we think that the program has played an important role in this very dramatic drop that we've seen here in Oregon. Now, what does this translate to? Well, not just the decreasing numbers of cigarettes that are smoked, but actually decreasing numbers of smokers. So, for example, compared with 1996, in 2002 there were 47% fewer 8th grade smokers and 26% fewer 11th grade smokers in Oregon. As you may know, people who start smoking in adolescence are it's much more difficult for them to quit when they get older. And so keeping people from starting what really is an addiction early in life is a very, very important thing that they need to do to protect their health. Similarly, compared with 1996 and 2002, Oregon had 2,200 fewer pregnant smokers, and that decline of 28% is about three times what's been seen nationally. This decline... Yes.
You know, we post no smoking, the prohibition for pregnant women, and as well as alcohol in restaurants. Do the rest of the states do that as well?
Madam Chair, I believe that is something that is commonly done in other states. I don't know off the top of my head if that is a requirement in all states. I can find that out for you as well. In addition to cigarette smoking, smokeless tobacco is also a very important issue, particularly in the rural areas of our state. And we believe that, in part as a result of this program, we've had 60,000 fewer adult Oregonians use smokeless tobacco today than in 1996. Now, how do we do this? How do we get this program effect? And this is a very important point. Everybody always wants to know what's the key, what's the one piece of the program that really works? And there really isn't one piece of the program that works. I mean, what really works is the comprehensive approach where people hear multiple messages in multiple ways in their lives that lead them to quit smoking or not take it up in the first place. I think it's really easy to understand how that happens. I mean, if somebody goes to a doctor and the doctor says, you know, you're smoking, you should stop smoking, well, that's very nice, and they may or may not take that advice to heart. But when they go home and their spouse tells them, you know, honey, I wish you would stop smoking, it really bothers me when you do that at home. When their child has to go to the emergency room because of an asthma exacerbation, and the doctor in the emergency room says, you know, your smoking probably played a role in triggering this asthma exacerbation. When their budget is tight because they're spending so much money on cigarettes, when their friends and the advertisements that they're seeing around them make it clear that maybe this isn't such a desirable behavior after all, you get the idea. When you hear it in multiple different ways, then you're actually apt to take that to heart and actually do something about it. And for that reason, we feel that the success of this program is really tied to the comprehensive nature of it. There isn't just one component that's responsible for its success. So the components that we do have, there are seven of them. They're listed on page 422 in the middle of the page. County and tribal-based programs. We have comprehensive school-based programs, multicultural outreach and education, the Oregon Tobacco Quit Line, which is a toll-free number to help smokers quit smoking, and then a public awareness and education focus that encompasses our media campaign and some other kinds of educational efforts. In addition to that, we do a lot of program evaluation, and the data that you've seen come from that effort, and also a small amount of the dollars are held for statewide leadership and coordination. Almost all of this money goes out the door, doesn't stay at the state level. Most of it goes to support community organizations and also county coalitions as well.
Do you have any data relating to the bill that we passed last session, which is our workplace, no smoking, which was very, I think, Oregon had led the nation. Thank you, Dr. Bates, and others.
Thank you. I was going to bring it up. Thank you.
Who, those of us who pushed and voted for that, and where we have approximately 95% of our workplace, with some exceptions, which are bars and taverns, are tobacco free. Has there been any information or data that tells us whether it's been good since we've done that, or what have been the outcomes?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we have had almost just a very, very small number of complaints about violations of the law, and that suggests to us that, in fact, almost everybody is complying with the law, which I think is a wonderful thing. We do know not from our experience specifically in Oregon, since I think it may be too early for us to really be able to measure this, but certainly from experience in other states, that when you do have a smoking ban in the workplace, that this helps in a number of ways. First of all, people are not exposed to secondhand smoke, that is non-smokers primarily, but also people who do smoke are encouraged to quit. It's a little more of a hassle for them to have to smoke during the day, and so I think that's a very effective measure and really was a step forward for the state.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much. Doctor, the activities that you were describing earlier under the fourth bullet that speak to the outreach activities, how much of this is jeopardized by budget cuts? This is a description of what was. How much of this is actually going to be able to go forward?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley. In the so-called sixth special session, as you all know, the program was suspended. As a result of that, all of the staff at the state level, which I believe is about 8 or 10 FTEs, have been laid off, save one or two of those, because I believe we were able to find some funding for a third from Washington State. The other staff have been laid off. In addition, we have had to cut all of our contracts with our community-based organizations, including the multicultural organizations that were funded through this program. That's resulted in a cut of 73 FTEs outside of the State Health Department. So those are all folks out at the community level and county level. I think that, as I said, the program is the way we're trying very hard to look at this is suspended. This is obviously a decision that you all are going to have to make about what's going to happen in the next biennium, and one that I'm very, very concerned about. I think that this is a highly successful and vital program for us to have, And we really need to be addressing this very important health problem that we have. Obviously, I recognize there are a lot of other things pulling on those dollars, but as I said, this is the leading preventable cause of death and disability. It's also something that's been approved not once but twice, actually, by the voters, that dollars be spent on tobacco education and prevention.
Thank you. And follow-up, Madam Chair? Thank you. The Oregon Tobacco Quit Line, is that still functional?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, no, that has also let me just back up for 1 second. As of April 7th, all of the work on those contracts will cease. And I believe April 7th is also the date for the quit line, the layoffs, because it takes some time for all of that to happen. At the state level, I believe, are effective as of April 15th, although some staff have already moved on. You know, to start up the program again in July will also take some time, and there's no doubt that we will lose some ground. We're going to have to hire staff, get things rolling again, and we're working as hard as we can with our community partners to try to lay the groundwork so that we can be up and running as fast as possible. But there's no doubt that we're going to lose some time because of this setback.
And one additional follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
The tribal-based program, is that also ended?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, absolutely.
All right. Thank you very much.
Representative Bates.
Yeah, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator, for asking several questions I want to ask also, and I want to bring that forward. Many of us saw what happened in Special Session 6, Session 6 as a real loss for the state, but one we couldn't avoid at that time, and we are anxious to restart this program. I think it might be helpful for this committee and others in considering that, if you can find states that have similar demographics and similar smoking populations that don't have a program like this and can show the stark difference, would be important. It's going to be difficult to find those. As we know, California for years has had a very tough law on smoking in public, including the workplace. But I don't know if they have an actual active program to get people to quit smoking. And I'm not sure what goes on in Washington either. But that might be something that allows a good, quick comparison. Because I believe your program has been very successful and needs to be supported. But it might be helpful if we could show something and say, yeah, here's what happens. You don't have it. Here's what you do. Of course, the alternative is you can run the program right here on an experimental basis a little longer and see what happens without the program. But I really want to do that, okay?
I guess what he's saying is that it would be nice for us to have some comparison data to justify or validate our decisions.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, thank you very much. I did bring with me today, I know this is difficult to see, but I'll try to borrow your pen, Barry. I'll try to illustrate with the pen here. This is a paper that was written about California's experience. And over here is the smoking prevalence on the y-axis and the years on the x-axis. And this dark line here, I know you can't see it, but I'm sort of approximating it with my pen here, shows what happened during California's very effective anti-tobacco campaign, really very dramatic drops in smoking prevalence. Now, in 1994, there was a dramatic cut in that program, a 57% cut in that program's budget. And I don't know if you can see it here, but this line that looked like this now is flat and actually maybe curving a little bit up. This is actually just 2 years' worth of follow-up data. You don't expect the effects of this program, just as it takes a few years for them to accumulate, they don't disappear totally overnight. But I think it's clear that with that kind of dramatic cut, there's absolutely no program effect anymore. And we know that obviously the tobacco industry is interested in selling cigarettes and actively, you know, promoting that in a variety of ways. And without something to counter that, it's very clear, I think, that the prevalence is going to increase. And the experience since that time in California has borne that out. So I think this is a pretty dramatic illustration that with defunding that there was a dramatic change in the trajectory here of what we were seeing with regard to smoking prevalence. And I'll be happy to, if any of you want to see the actual paper.
We'll make copies available.
The print is rather small.
Just fine, Madam Chair.
Well, that's fine. I should probably borrow your glasses, Representative Westland. But, you know, you can share. But I still think that the comparison that Representative Bates recommended would be welcome.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, we will prepare that for you. Okay. Well, despite the successes of the program, we still have a substantial problem here. About 500,000 Oregonians still smoke. Tobacco use has a major impact on the economy, costs Oregonians an estimated $1.8 billion annually in health-related expenses and lost productivity. We also know that the successes of the program to date save the Oregon Health Plan at this point in time about $10 million a year. This is primarily in savings for heart disease and the more acute kinds of illnesses that result from smoking. So there are some very dramatic effects that, again, we will lose if we're not able to continue the program.
Barry, you had mentioned, I believe last week we talked some about the number one health issue in this country, and I'm assuming that it's also in Oregon, is obesity. And you had mentioned that you were going to start, you've got some program designs that you're thinking about. And I would appreciate it if someplace in this discussion that you bring it forward as to what the agency is planning, so that we don't lose that, you know, not only is tobacco a major health issue that we put in the forefront of this body, that there are other major issues that we need to begin to address, whether it's through information or whether it's through exercise or whether it's through whatever. But I'm very aware that that is costing millions and billions of dollars, just like the tobacco issue did.
Madam Chair, we will, and I think the substance of my comments yesterday, or perhaps, yes, yesterday afternoon, was that we do have an application into the Centers for Disease Control for some assistance in developing a nutrition and physical activity program, and we'll give you some more information about that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I may just say a word or two about that now. We do have, as part of our chronic disease prevention activities, we've been quite interested in this issue. And as you know, obesity is a very, very important health issue. Rates of obesity in the United States among adults have doubled since the 1980s. Here in Oregon, quoted or characterized as having said that we were the lardiest state in the West.
The lardiest.
by the Willamette Week. We were the first state on the West Coast to have more than 20% of our adults report a body mass index in the obese range. So about 60% of Oregonians are either overweight or obese.
When you apply for your grant, and I don't know if there's anything out there that directed towards that. But when I look at our dietary intake, and particularly if we're, you know, we've targeted kids with cigarettes and try to get them to prevent, and what we would do to try to get young people to have better nutritional habits, and particularly in our educational schools, when I go and I see all the junk that's there that actually contributes to the lardosis, it's a little wonder that we're carrying around so much, and it becomes a pattern and a habit, and we're all of us, it's hard for us to break these habits. So I would hope that there's some kind of pilot project that will begin to look at the foods that we are ingesting, particularly in our school communities, and so that we can begin changing some habits and behaviors early.
Madam Chair, I just bring to your attention in that respect, we did have a conference a few weeks ago that brought together people from local health departments, school districts, and the like to talk about physical activity and nutrition. And there's going to be a national conference here in the state in about 30 days with the Surgeon General will be here as well. I think it's called the Walk-In or something of that kind. But at any rate, this has certainly become an issue of national concern, and we want to participate in helping Oregonians achieve better health through control of weight, but also more physical activity, which is also important. And I think we can provide some written information to the committee about what this project will look like.
Thank you. Just want to keep it on the radar screen.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'd point out that your personal program of keeping us having lunch is very effective. It's working.
Okay. Madam Chair, the next program I'd like to talk about is our Emerging Infections Program. This is a federally funded program that Oregon is one of, I believe, 9 states in the country to have secured funding for this. And this has allowed us over the years to have the capacity to investigate a variety of new kinds of infections. We know that not only antibiotic resistance, but the emergence of new microbes, as everybody's been reading about the, now I don't want to use the acronym, severe acute respiratory syndrome, that is occurring primarily in Asia. We haven't yet had any confirmed cases here. There have been about 60 suspect cases, or I believe 69 was the last count I heard, in the United States as a whole. All of those people are doing fine. The case definition for this is something that's really rather vague. Basically, somebody who has essentially a cold and has a history of travel to an area where this syndrome is known to be spread. That encompasses a lot of people, most of whom probably do not have this particular syndrome. But nonetheless, it's these kinds of new and emerging problems that we really need to stay on top of, and this program has enabled us to do that in a variety of ways. Meningococcus has been a persistent concern here, meningococcemia here in Oregon, after the emergence of a new strain back in, I believe, 94 was really when it peaked. Since that time, our rates of meningococcal disease have been falling, but I think, again, our capacity to investigate this and follow up on it has really been extremely helpful, not only in reassuring the public, but hopefully in saving lives and preventing spread of the illness. Some of the primary focus areas of this program include exploring how a variety of invasive bacterial pathogens, such as meningococcus, spread here in Oregon, investigating cases of occurrence of unexplained critical illnesses, detecting and controlling foodborne outbreaks. We recently had an outbreak related to alfalfa sprouts of Salmonella Newport. So being able to be on top of that, chase down quickly what the cause is, and pull a product off the market in this particular case is really very, very important. Another issue, if you will please turn to page 426, I want to briefly mention West Nile virus, because this is another emerging infection that's really of great concern to us. The chart that's on the left-hand side of the page shows the situation between 1999 and 2001 with regard to West Nile virus. Let me explain to you what that means. West Nile virus is a virus that had occurred in epidemics in various parts of the world, particularly in the Mediterranean area, but really had never been seen in the Western Hemisphere until 1999, when a cluster occurred in the New York City area. It took a little bit of time to chase down what the cause of this was, and in fact it was an astute veterinarian at the Bronx Botanical Gardens, or the Bronx Zoo, excuse me, who finally figured out that this was in fact West Nile virus and not some other viral cause that was causing this disease. At any rate, the map here, the dark states indicate the states where there had been West Nile virus that was found in mosquitoes or in animals, and then the hatched areas indicate human cases that had occurred along with that. This virus is primarily transmitted by mosquitoes. It is transmitted by mosquitoes, and birds are the primary host. The mosquito bites the bird, then bites you, and gives you the disease. That's the way it happens. Between 2001 and 2002, what's happened is really an explosion of this disease. And if you look at the map on the next to the right there, you'll see that there have been human cases in most states across the country. And really what's happened is the disease has sort of pushed up against the Rocky Mountains there. There was one human case in California. There was a dead bird that was found to be infected with West Nile virus in Washington. But as of yet, we haven't had any either animals or humans infected here in Oregon. Given this pattern of spread, however, we do expect that this is probably going to arrive this summer. And so having information, being able to respond to public concerns about this is really a very, very important function, and one that our emerging infections program really helps us do.
Representative Westland.
Just a point of curiosity. Did they ever figure out how it was introduced into the New York area?
Madam Chair, Representative Westland, that's a very interesting question. The short answer is no, although there are a variety of theories. One idea is that an infected bird was somehow blown in by a storm or brought in by somebody who was, you know, importing exotic birds, for example. Another thought is that perhaps an infected mosquito or some other kind of infected animal was brought in on a ship in ballast or something like that. So we don't really know how that occurred, but it had to be either mosquito or animal transmission, since you can't, once humans get infected, if a mosquito bites you and then bites somebody else, there shouldn't be any transmission of infection that way. It has to be a bird host or another animal where there's a large amounts of virus that are produced in the animal.
Thank you.
Okay, and I want to finish up here with a brief description of our role in the bioterrorism preparedness program. I know that you heard from Dr. Higginson yesterday about a lot of the great work that his group has been doing. And we have a small piece of that bioterrorism preparedness, and that is, first of all, the data piece. That's the public health surveillance piece. How will we know if we have a bioterrorism attack that occurs here? We need to have in place a strong public health system that can detect this, recognize it, and then respond. So the surveillance piece of bioterrorism is one piece that we're involved with. And the other is a piece of professional education. Doctors have to be able to, and other healthcare providers have to be able to recognize these illnesses when they see them. Most of them are quite unusual. Smallpox, for example, hasn't been seen for many, many years here in Oregon. And I brought with me a couple of examples. I will pass these out if any of you want them as souvenirs. Dr. Bates, you should have one of these already, I'm sure, up in your office. This is the kind of information that we're passing out to clinicians. This shows some pictures of smallpox, and this is some pictures of chickenpox, which is the disease that it's most likely to be confused with, particularly at the early stages. And there's a little algorithm for how to diagnose this. So these are the kinds of materials. This particular piece is produced by the Centers for Disease Control that we have been disseminating to doctors, and we have a variety of other educational venues that we've been trying to get that information out to the medical community. Funding for this program, again, is federal funding. As Dr. Higginson explained, it's part of that $14.2 million that came from CDC. Excuse me, there's my 50 cents, from the Centers for Disease Control for bioterrorism preparedness. Much of those dollars, of course, have gone out to county health departments, because county health departments, again, are really the front line in our work to be prepared to recognize a bioterrorist incident. And that has meant that primarily the county health departments need to hire bodies. They need to have folks who can do this work. There aren't enough people out there in the public health workforce to do this out of the blue, and so there's a great deal of training and education that goes on as well, and that's part of the work that my office does.
Madam Chair, I just want to point out, and not at the risk of opening a conversation which will take time, but Oregon actually had the first bioterrorism event that we know of prior to the anthrax during the recent history, when a salad bar in the Dalles was contaminated with salmonella. And Dr. Skeels was certainly critical in that. And it illustrates how what we have really in this office are detectives who understand how to take data and figure out what's going on. And it's a really important function. I also wanted to point out that with West Nile virus, and you may recall yesterday Grant Higginson pointed this out, we used the preparedness strategies and risk communication models that have been developed with federal funding to begin to prepare to communicate with the public about West Nile virus, because although the disease in terms of proportion is not as urgent, the public anxiety about this is going to be enormous, as it has been in other parts of the country. Just a couple of points to tie this
I've
presentation
forgotten that
together.
We were that piece of history.
Pardon?
I'd forgotten the piece of history.
Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, with that, I'll be happy to answer any other questions, but I think I've given you some sense of how we do our work and the kinds of skills and capacity that we have there.
Do you also get involved with the outbreaks of of staph infections in hospitals and clinics? And
Madam Chair, we do to a limited extent. Most of those kinds of infectious outbreaks that occur in institutions like hospitals are generally controlled by infection control practitioners at those institutions. However, we certainly work closely with those folks. We're, I think, well plugged into their networks. We're available as consultants and as a source of information for those folks. And where it's appropriate, we will step in and make recommendations and so forth, again, through our county health departments primarily. But
they do report the staph outbreaks, don't they, to the health division?
Madam Chair, staph infections are actually not a reportable condition here in Oregon. So we do have a sort of vague part of our reportable disease rules that say that any disease of public health significance is reportable, and I suppose that a staph outbreak would fit that description, but staph itself is not reportable.
Madam Chair,
yes.
I wanted to respond to the request for a copy of the report we made to the January 2002 Emergency Board, which we provided to fiscal staff for distribution, and it identifies some of the gaps at the local health department level, and you had asked about those yesterday. So that report should be available to folks.
Yeah. Thank you.
Excuse me, Madam Chair, that was the report that I passed out yesterday.
Madam Chair, we're going to, thank you, Mel. We're going to change the order a bit. I've asked Dr. Skeels from the Public Health Laboratories to discuss the role of the laboratory in Oregon. There certainly is a connection with our epidemiology and disease prevention program, but we do much, much more, and there are also issues regarding our physical plant that we are sure that you will want to hear about.
Welcome, Dr. Skeels.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mike Skeels. I'm the administrator of the Office of Oregon State Public Health Laboratories. As Barry said, we are a service organization that provides a lot of the laboratory testing support for the exactly the kind of programs that you've just heard described. What I would like to do is give you a quick overview of the three programs that comprise our office and then focus on the facility issue, which Barry mentioned a moment ago. The first program that we operate is the newborn screening program, and this has been in existence really for over 40 years. This is a program in which we take a few drops of baby's blood at the time they're born. This is submitted to our laboratory, and we can screen them for a number of genetic disorders, which are defects in body chemistry that can lead to brain damage, other kinds of profound disability, and even death. We test every newborn baby in Oregon, Idaho, Alaska, Nevada, and Hawaii for these disorders so that we have a very high test volume. Excuse me. So far in our program, we've tested over 3 million babies, and we found over 1,300 infants that were affected with one of these disorders, and we've been able to refer those to treatment and support community physicians in treating those patients. I want to be sure and mention at this point that this is a partnership between us and the Oregon Health and Science University, which I'm sure I'm going to mistakenly call OHSU in a moment, but I'll beg your forgiveness ahead of time if I do that.
Rosie does not forgive.
Oh, thank you.
You don't need our forgiveness. Just pay.
Just pay.
Okay, that's right. Thank you.
No problem.
We've been working with them for 40 years on this program, and the way it works is we do the initial screening and the confirmation of these disorders, and then the medical consultants at OHSU are available to provide us with the information we need to help manage the patient, and more important, they provide a direct connection with the practitioners in the community, one of whom was Representative Bates at one point. And they help the doctors who are managing these babies, and they serve as their experts for rare disorders that these physicians might not have seen before in their practice. And this has been really one of the biggest, most pivotal years for newborn screening in Oregon since its inception 40 years ago. As a result of House Bill 2268, which you folks passed in the last session, we were able to expand this program so that Oregon babies who were being screened for only six disorders are now being screened for 26 disorders using a new technology. This required a fee increase. And we did exactly what we told you we were going to do 2 years ago, which is implement this. It's been up and going for Oregon since last October. We've already found six or seven Oregon babies and another four or so babies from Idaho, which have these disorders.
Thank you, Chair Winters. I truly apologize for interrupting, but you said something that intrigued me. You talked about how the testing has been increased. Without knowing the details of a traditional Blue Cross Blue Shield plan, what would a baby not part of the Babies First program be tested for? How many different?
Chair Winters, Representative Smith, if I understand your question correctly, we do all the screening for these metabolic disorders for all babies, regardless of whether they have health insurance or they have Oregon Health Plan coverage or one thing or the other. The hospitals purchase kits from us, which they then use to collect the samples and then send to us, and then the hospitals and the physicians are reimbursed by the health insurer for that baby's family.
So then, Chair, I need a little 101 here.
Well, Representative Smith, the screening that they're doing is not Babies First. Representative
might explain. Madam Chair, Doctor, if you'd, I don't want to interrupt her, but sometimes I can put things in terms that, because I know both sides of the fence here. The screening we're doing here is a screen which take a little bit of blood from the child's heel, put a little cap about this big, we call it portal squares, and they look for inborn, what we call inborn errors of metabolism. Those are things that are wrong inside a child you cannot see in the outside. It's been going on for years, and we've learned to look for more and more of those because these children don't die usually. They actually grow up, and most of them are severely retarded or other serious medical problems. They'll become wards of the state in most cases and have, at best, a vastly diminished quality of life. This has been a huge breakthrough to be able to identify first the disease that caused this and then find a way to test for it. And for many of them, it's something as simple as giving them thyroid medication, or in many cases, simply removing something from their diet they can't metabolize and prevents them from becoming retarded. It has nothing to do with any of the screening programs we do for social reasons or anything else. It's easy to kind of get those two confused in our heads because you hear screening and you think newborn, and this is a program that's been carried on for years. It is incredibly cost-effective. I don't know what those tests cost, but they're just pennies. What you get out of it, and while you pick up very few infants, the ones you pick up are, just on a financial basis, a huge savings for these states. That's why all these states have come in and contracted with us. For reasons I don't really understand, Oregon somehow became a leader in this area of technology and applying that technology, so that the states around us have brought that to us, saying, would you do this for us? And that's exactly what you've contracted to do, is my understanding. I've been to the laboratory there, I got to tell you, I was impressed by the people, impressed by the equipment. The building looked like a third world country, okay, nothing personal. But you guys did a wonderful, incredible job, and it's such a small part of medicine that most people are kind of like, what are you guys talking about? But you're talking about something that's devastating to the child, very rare, incredibly expensive to state if not taken care of, a very cost-effective program.
Thank you. I apologize for setting up.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, that was a way better answer than I could possibly have given anyway, so thank you, Representative Bates. I do want to focus on one thing you said, though, Representative Bates, and that is that this is a collaborative effort with five states, and because the disorders are relatively rare, although on the aggregate they occur about 1 in 2,500 births now that we're testing for so many different things, it is highly cost-effective to pool resources, and there's a real economy of scale in this because of the technology. So that's why the other states have been attracted to our program also, because we've been doing it a long time, and we think doing it very well. So this is one of our programs, and this one alone receives almost 500,000 specimens per biennium, and the specimens, we perform about 5 million tests. So this is a high-volume activity for us. This is one of our major things that we do.
Representative Smith, the narrative on and program description and history on the PKU screening, which is what he's talking about.
Of course,
about.
That will cost you some money.
That will cost me. I paid $20 in advance. So
you got credit.
I got credit. On 4-83, and it covers actually comprehensively the elements of the screening activity, including its partnering with Oregon State Health Science University. See, I didn't enact this.
Chair Winters, the second program that I want to describe is communicable disease testing, which could be subtitled What Happens When You Don't Wash Your Hands or Practice Other Protective Health Behaviors, and you end up in our laboratory. We've been doing this for almost 100 years. Our centennial will be in December of this year. We were created under the State Board of Health in 1903 for this specific purpose, and that is to provide lab testing to prevent and control communicable diseases in the community. This takes several different forms, but I'll just tell you briefly that almost all the samples that we get come from local health departments. So this is primarily an activity in support of local government, and it provides needed surveillance data for assessing the burden of communicable diseases in communities, and also to help direct and provide information for our epidemiology staff at the state level as well. A lot of these samples come from people who are seen in community clinics and local health departments for a wide range of different diseases like chlamydia and other sexually transmitted diseases, hepatitis A and B, tuberculosis, human immunodeficiency virus. You can read the list that I've provided on page 486 if you'd like. But these are all of the things that you could think of that could affect the health of a community because they're transmissible from person to person or through some vehicle like food or water. Salmonella, E. coli, Norwalk virus, parasites like Giardia and Cryptosporidium, a number of different agents. And so this not only contributes to patient care for those clients that are seen in local health departments, but it also provides information about what's going on in the population regarding the spread of communicable diseases. And this can be used, as I said, to guide epidemiologic efforts as well. Another type of communicable disease testing that we do is for unusual or significant diseases that really no one else tests for, things like rabies from animal exposure, botulism, diphtheria, and other vaccine-preventable diseases. Some of the newer or more exotic emerging infectious diseases that Dr. Cohn mentioned, like West Nile virus and hantavirus, just to give you some idea about how this works, now that severe acute respiratory syndrome has been discovered and it appears that the agent is a coronavirus, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention will eventually, probably within a few months, make available to us the materials that we need to do lab testing to diagnose that. And this is what happened with West Nile virus. It's what happened with hantavirus. It's what happened with every other newly emerging disease, is it gets discovered and characterized usually at the federal level, and then they go about empowering and providing the resources that the state public health laboratories need so that we can detect outbreaks and we can do the diagnosis here locally. So that's sort of a natural evolution of things.
Mike, are there any other countries that is as comprehensive and as vigilant as the United States is in its partnering? Because the Center for Disease Control,
you pay this much,
and its work with the states and your work with the counties, and looking at that system is one that has a good communication flow, and I just wondered if other countries were as vigilant and on top of these issues as we are in this country.
Chair Winters, Mel Cohn could probably answer that question better than I could, but I'll just tell you, yes, there are many countries, particularly those in the more developed part of the world, that have strong central federal public health presence with disease reporting and investigation. I think some of them have a more integrated system than we have in the United States. Public health tends to be a state-by-state activity with quite a bit of divergence in how well disease reporting occurs depending on the state and the locale and so forth, but I'm getting into an area that I don't know a whole lot about, so I'd ask you to refer your question to Dr.
Save it for mail.
Okay, thank you. We do typing. If there's you heard Dr. Cohn mention a salmonella outbreak in Sprouts, the reason they knew there was an outbreak is because our lab discovered that there was a cluster of novel serotypes that we don't normally see that can be traced back then to the food source, and it can be linked to the people. We do DNA fingerprinting for bacteria for the same purpose. In other words, we sort of take things to the population level so that we can tell whether there's an outbreak going on. We're the early warning system. And then a third component of this is rapid and reliable response to disease outbreaks. And we've been doing this for a really long time, whether the disease is something that's common like salmonellosis or in the past things like diphtheria, or whether it's one of the more new emerging diseases, or whether it's a bioterrorist threat. And I know that you've heard from both Dr. Higginson and Dr. Cohn about this, so I won't belabor it, but I'll say that our laboratory is a real linchpin in the bioterrorism response effort. It's our lab to which all of these environmental powders have been sent, and which has tooled up very extensively so that we can quickly identify agents like those that cause anthrax and plague and tularemia and so forth within just a few hours now to tell the public safety people and public health community whether they have one of these agents or not. So we've made great strides there as a part of the bioterrorism grant that you've heard described. I think I'll stop there with the communicable disease testing program and just move on to laboratory compliance and quality assurance, which is the third and final program I wanted to mention. This particular one doesn't involve any laboratory testing on our part, but rather regulatory activities. The biggest part of this is the licensure of 1,900 medical laboratories in the state. We do this under the Federal Clinical Laboratory Improvement Amendments. We're the state designated agency for carrying out this federal law, but we also have a state laboratory licensing law as well, which is ORS 438. The two mesh very well together, and so it's a dual program so that one inspector and one person in the office who's monitoring the results of proficiency testing by labs and so forth is providing both the federal certificate and the state license as well. Excuse me. So everything from very small physician's office practices all the way through very large hospitals and regional medical center laboratories receive a license from us as well as a federal certificate. We also operate the Oregon Environmental Laboratory Accreditation Program, and that is a state-level activity under the National Environmental Laboratory Accreditation Program. This is a voluntary program for private environmental laboratories. With this sort of good housekeeping seal of approval, they can bid for business in Oregon and in other states, and this is increasingly becoming the standard. It's also going to be required for community drinking water programs as well. It's going to replace the existing drinking water lab certification program, and I think Gail Shibley may be talking about that after a while. We also have a laboratory response network that we're building with the private clinical laboratories, that's the hospital and clinic labs in the state, to make sure that everybody knows when they see an agent that might be a bioterrorist agent, and they know what to do with it and what not to do with it and how to send it to us and what to expect from us and so forth. I think I'll stop there with a description of our major programs and just say that there are a couple of packages that I need to highlight. The package number 020 and package number 165 are necessary for us to continue the expanded newborn screening program that we have that was authorized under House Bill 2268. These are in the governor's balanced budget, and we anticipate that you'll pass those. We hope you will, but I just want to highlight that those are necessary for continuing this activity, which you heard Representative Bates describe so well. The other major issue for us in the future is our facility. You heard Barry mention that a few minutes ago. And in the room here are Faribor's Poxaresh, who's the Deputy Administrative Officer for our department, as well as Lori Warner, who's the Administrator of the Facilities Division at the Department of Administrative Services. And they're available if you have questions that I can't answer. But I'll just tell you in a nutshell that the space that we're in now is on the Portland State University campus. It's in Science Building 2. It's on the lower two floors. And right behind us on the other side of the same building is the Department of Environmental Quality Laboratory. And, excuse me, we've been there since 1977 when it was remodeled from a parking garage. And we had a 20-year lease that expired on June 30th of 1997. We've been operating under lease extensions ever since. We now have, I believe, a lease signed which will allow us continued one-year extensions through June 30th of 2007. So we do have continued temporary facilities, but Portland State University really wants us out of that space, and they feel that it would be in their best interest to be able to convert that to classroom and research space, and we frankly need something that's more amenable to new technologies and gives us more flexibility and more biological safety. Every time we want to add an instrument or we need to upgrade the safety of the facility, it's very expensive to do. We're looking at a remodel right now of just two little rooms that together would fill maybe a fourth of this room, and they want several hundred thousand dollars to do that, just to upgrade it to the level that we need for doing the basic work for bioterrorism. So it's because the building has such old mechanical systems, everything in it, particularly the air handling system, is now inadequate. It's also laid out in a way that is not conducive to the kind of work that we need to do. So House Bill 5004 has been introduced, which would provide certificate of participation authority to build a new facility for or to remodel an existing building, to be more correct, for the Department of Environmental Quality Lab and the State Public Health Lab, so that we could co-locate, share facilities, and reduce the overall cost for these two laboratories. I know that DEQ's director, Stephanie Halleck, has made a presentation to her Ways and Means Subcommittee on this.
Where is the DEQ lab located?
Chair Winters, they're currently located right behind us in the same building that we're in.
And they're talking about remodeling that building?
No, we're talking about the two of our agencies going together and locating at another site, which would be a renovation of an existing building.
Okay. Where is the new site?
The new site has not been selected, and no money is being requested in the 03-05 budget for this.
For the new site?
Right. Or for any aspect of this. The facility would not be developed until after the 03-05 budget period, so that we wouldn't have to start paying for it until after that.
Lori?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lori Warner, the Department Administrative Facilities Division Manager.
My question is, and I know that you're talking about 07, or you're looking out in the future for either finding another site and building on another site, and I would, one of the objectives of Governor Kulongoski, which I concur, is that we look at communities where there are needs, and that we're not concentrating new activities within just one specific geographical area. So I guess I would like to know, where are you looking in the metropolitan, where are you looking to locate the lab, or have you gotten that far in your planning?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we did a preliminary search to look at what was out on the market last spring and had DEQ and Health look at what was on the market at that time for buildings. And we looked predominantly in the metropolitan area, mostly related to the program needs by both DEQ and Health Division to have access for samples and such. And I think that's a condition probably they need to speak to in regards to the geographic distribution of where we looked for sites. But there were half a dozen buildings that were suitable, could have been remodeled, And at this point, those buildings are probably no longer available, but we got some sense of what was out there at that point.
Even within the metropolitan Portland area, I think that there are distinct districts, unless you have to be close to, you know, whether you're talking even close to freeways or close to the Oregon Health Science University. I'm just trying to get some idea because I know that two senators who serve on this panel would be very interested in to knowing where you're going to locate. Three, in fact. Three senators who sit on this panel who are from the Portland area would be interested in knowing where your future plans are taking you.
Chair Winters, may I respond to that?
Certainly.
You just describe three or four of the very considerations that we have. One is we need to be in the Portland metro area, partly because that's where about half of our samples come from, and these are very time-critical samples. We also would prefer to be not too far from the airport because we make a lot of trips there to send things to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and to pick up packages and shipments of things and one thing and the other. We also would prefer to be close to freeways so that when people are delivering things to us, they're accessible and they don't have to spend an extra 10 or 15 minutes driving through surface streets to get there. And we also would like very much to be close to the Oregon Health and Science University and the public health programs that we serve. The reason for wanting to be close to Oregon Health and Science University is that we have a very close working relationship, as I said, with the medical consultants there for the newborn metabolic screening program. And also, we work closely with epidemiology staff in our own Portland State Office building and so forth. So we're feeling very flexible about where in the Portland metropolitan area we would be located as long as we can meet those criteria.
Well, I guess if I was looking at airports and looking at freeway access and some of those, the easy in and out, with the exception of Oregon Health Science University, I would be thinking it's somewhere out by far northeast, out in that particular geographical area, because you would have both the access to the airport, you'd have the access to the freeway, and some of those criteria would require driving a little bit to Oregon Health Science University. But I was just curious as to where, you know, what your criteria was and where you were looking within metropolitan Portland. And I raised that on behalf of the three senators who serve on this committee.
Senator Winters, I might add that the sheet that went out that requested proposals was open to the whole metropolitan Portland area. However, the responses mostly were from the east side, northeast area that you're suggesting. But that was at a point in time. So if we go back out and open that up again, it really is dependent upon what's available on the market at the time and the location. We look at it and we talk with the agencies to say, that is this workable?
I think given our current climate that probably that you keep those issues in mind, mm-hmm. if you send your RFPs out. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Lauren.
That concludes what I have to say, Madam Chair. I'd be happy to answer questions if anyone has them.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Winters. I want to let you know how much I appreciate your comments on the location of this facility. Setting aside the merits of the need, I can tell you I'm very sensitive to ensuring that any facility the state finances is located in a distressed area. And in this case, if it means an urban distressed area, I sure hope you give that serious consideration, because setting aside the merits, that's what I look at.
Thank you. Barry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm becoming increasingly optimistic that we may get close to finishing the public health section today.
We're going to try.
I'm pleased to introduce Vanelda Dodson, who is the Administrator of our Office of Family Health. She has a number of programs to discuss with you, and the text begins on page 4-37 behind the public health tab.
Welcome, Vanelda. She's no stranger to this body.
No, absolutely not.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, For the record, my name is Denelda Dodds. I'm an administrator for the Office of Family Health. And I'd like to direct you to page 4-38. And I'd like to spend some time talking about the systemic spectrum that we deal with in the Office of Family Health. Sometimes it's confusing to people as to what we really do, since we seem to dabble a lot in other people's areas also. For example, the pyramid is there to indicate that we do some things in direct services. For example, we may be doing services for children with special health care needs or for prenatal care. The other area that we often do work, and most of these services that we are talking about are through the activities we do with our local partners from community health departments. In fact, about 85% of the resources that come into the office then go back out into the communities. As has been mentioned before, those are the arms by which the work gets done. A major part of what we do within our office is under the title of enabling services. This is where you would see our clinical programs. Many of those would be, like Barry mentioned the other day, our Women's and Infants and Children's Nutrition Program. We also have a lot of home visiting programs, which I think Representative Smith referred to as far as our Babies First Outreach Case Management Program. We will also do a lot of work with pregnant women with maternity case management and following high-risk infant and pregnant women.
Can you provide me with a comparison or distinction, if you will, between Babies First and Healthy Start? We get a lot of questions about those two and whether or not there are duplication of effort. It would really help to define what are the activities and outcomes of a Babies First and those that are of Healthy Start.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I can provide you with some written information, but just briefly, the Babies First program is a nursing program targeted to a specific high-risk population and provides a continuum of health services. Babies First coordinates and links with the Healthy Start program, and in many times there will be services for a family where they may come into a Healthy Start program due to situations with that family or with the child, may then be referred to Babies First for a follow-up of a health issue or health problem, and then be referred back to the Healthy Start program once that condition is manageable. This is a good example of this would be a child that's a failure to thrive child, or a family is having a newborn baby and the parent is having difficulty with breastfeeding support. Then the Babies First nurse would be working with that family once that problem is resolved, and if that family is identified as having continued needs in the area of social services, then a referral would be made to Healthy Start. When these two programs were first looked at, oftentimes some of the discussion, as I recall, when we were talking about the families and the families' kinds of needs that they have, often we had said sometimes these individuals have health problems and sometimes they just need somebody to go home with them to kind of help them manage through the day. So it's a continuum of services that we would provide, with Babies First providing the health and with Healthy Start providing the social services support.
I think because the question I know is going to arise as we get through the budget discussions and begin to get into detail. So it would be very helpful if there is a clear delineation of functions between the Healthy Start and Babies First. I know that members of this panel have raised concerns and have wanted to assure that there isn't a duplication of effort, and given these the limited resources, I believe this body needs to have that kind of information. Representative Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Even I am confused about these programs. Supposedly, I know what's going on. Donalda, could you tell me how are we identifying the children and Baby First at this time? What's the actual process? Is it the hospital level, the physician's level? What kind of response are you getting to those?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates. It's both. Most oftentimes it will be a referral from the hospital. When the program was first established, it was identified that we thought 10% of infants born would probably have a medical condition that would need follow-up. Subsequent to that, we found it's more like 20%. And in fact, over 51% of the contacts by the baby's first nurses are within that first 3 months of life. And historically, we've been seeing about 9,000 individuals in a year, and we have about 44,000 births. And usually the types of conditions that we would see would be like a failure to thrive, cleft lip and palate, small for birth age, those types of physical health problems. They don't go into what we would see with those infants that would be a child with a special health care need, such as somebody that has a chronic heart problem that was born or somebody that was in intensive care. Although the baby's first nurse may visit that family while the infant is in the hospital to help give consultation to the physician about what's the home condition for that family, what will that baby be going home to, what are the resources in that community. Is that right? Okay, moving on. Those enabling services that I was mentioning are the second tier in our triangle, in our pyramid. The third area that we focus on are population-based services. Here we also interact with other public health services with newborn screening. Here we oftentimes will provide follow-up for those infants that are identified with a newborn metabolic problem. Or in the last 6 years, we've also been working with the hospitals and the communities on newborn hearing screening to assure that every infant that is born receives a hearing test so that if they have a hearing problem, they can receive intervention within the first 6 months of life, because then this will help promote language development later on.
Perhaps it's in this document someplace, but within each one of your program, do you have per program your performance measures and your outcomes for those programs? So I thought about that when you were talking about Babies First and the activities of Babies First, and it would be and it's probably in here someplace, and we just don't know where to find it.
Madam Chair, that's information that we can provide for you. I don't know that it's in our document. We do have benchmarks that we do strive for. Those tend to be more high level than the interim measures that you were probably referring to.
Yeah. What I'm interested in is the outcomes of the activities of the particular program. So if you've seen X number of children, and within the X number of children, what were the medical categories, or what was the reason for seeing them, and what were the outcome results? I think that'll get us to actually that differentiation between, it'll help us in the differentiation between Healthy Start and Babies First. You know, you mentioned that there were some youngsters who had cleft palates. You know, I think that's valuable information for us to know of that 9,000 universe, what were the problems that required the services of the visiting nurse? Is that what you'd like to see, Dr.
Yes, Bates? Yes, Madam Chair, that would be very helpful. I've also had another question cross my mind, if I could ask, please.
Certainly, Dr. Bates. Representative Bates.
Whatever. I confuse myself most of the time. Out of the 44,000 births in Oregon, I know a large percentage of those are Medicaid or Medicaid-eligible patients, maybe as high as half. I'm not sure the exact figures. For those children born that are below 185% of federal poverty level, basically FCHIP or other children, would these programs qualify for medical match? Has that been looked at or discussed?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, yes, they would. And, in fact, in our Babies First program, we do a match on a fee-for-service. We've been looking at the comparison between revenue that the state could bring in doing a fee-for-service versus an administrative match and evaluating which would be the better route to take with this particular program. But currently, Babies First is a matched program, 60-40.
But we show on your priority general fund and no other fund at the same level. There's no match it shows here.
Madam Chair, I think that the reason for that is because our local county health departments are the ones that provide the match. So we provide services to the resources go to the counties. The counties then provide that match at their local level.
How do we capture that for our Medicaid match? Do you want to help some?
I'll try to help. Madam Chair, these are local funds and not state match funds.
The one million. Those are general funds.
I'll take it.
Okay. And they go to the county?
Yes.
They go to the county. Mm-hmm. And the county then in turn does what?
Madam Chair, the counties then use their non-federal dollars as a match to draw down the match, the federal match. So that
Mr. Britton, would you help us here? Because
I think Chair Winters is referring to this prioritized list that was just handed out. And at the top of the list is, in terms of office priority number one, Babies First Local Services. It's $1 million of general fund. And the question is, where's the federal match on that? This isn't local generated money. This is general fund, state general fund. Is that right?
Madam Chair, these are general fund dollars that flow through our office to the local health departments. The local health departments then use those dollars and draw down their own match. They bill the Medicaid office directly, so it does not show in our budget because the general fund are the only ones that flow through our office. When the program was set up originally, 12 years ago, there was not enough general fund within the state budget to draw down the federal match. So it was an agreement with our county partners that they would provide the match at the local level. So they do the billing, and then they get reimbursed, and then they pay back their portion.
So they bill the federal counterpart direct, correct?
Through Medicaid. Correct.
Through Medicaid. Medicaid pays them. And then they refund you?
No.
Madam Chair, may I ask a question differently?
Sorry.
Do you put up $1 million? Do they put up some local funds to match that $1 million? And then that total amount gets drawn down with the feds? Is that what's happening?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, correct. And in fact, at the local level, there are a lot more dollars that go into this program than what we give them, so that they are able to leverage even more dollars. For example, in some counties, we may give them $90,000, but their whole program is $400,000.
I think I need to know, we need to know, this body needs to know totally the scope, which means how much that you're going giving to each county out of this $1 million plus. How much are they contributing to that $1 million? And then how much are they billing the Medicaid for? So that we have a complete understanding of what is occurring in this particular program.
Madam Chair, can we, what I would propose here, because this is a complicated area,
it's
and the federal funds do not flow through this program, so it makes it difficult to display this. If we can bring this back in the form of a flow sheet, a breakdown of our agreements with the counties, what the assurances are, and what the claiming mechanism is so that you can see that displayed.
Yeah, because we're hearing from, we're hearing messages from the counties that, we're not doing enough in our partnering, and then we're hearing that we have this kind of arrangement going on, and we don't really know totally what these dollars are buying and what the scope is. And so whether it's this particular program, Babies First, or any of the others where you have that kind of arrangement that's going on with the county, I think we would like to know what it is, how much it is, and what is the Medicaid match arrangement.
Right. May I make one clarifying comment? Because I think the fact that you don't have all the information may throw a cloud over this program. The eligibility or the requirements for participation at the local level is not based on Medicaid eligibility.
That's right.
The claiming is done at the local site, and it's done on a billing basis, but it's not billed through the Office of Family Health. And I think when you see that displayed, and I will assure that you get that in our wrap-up, because it's somebody's going to have to draw the picture.
Because it could be, Barry, that this is a new avenue that we can do some things, perhaps in some other areas. We're looking for ways of managing these budgets, and so I think we're just open to how these funding streams are being done and captured locally to provide particular services. Did I say that right?
I think you're right. I mean, it's educational for us, so that if you've got a program that works, we might be able to apply it in other areas. But we'd like to see how that program works, I think, so we have a better understanding.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, our goal is better outcomes for babies, and that's in any way that we can work with you to make that happen, we will do that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shields.
If I can take us back to where we were in this little pyramid that we're working.
Yes.
Looks to me like we've got one-fourth of the way through sentence three under the population-based services. She said these include newborn screenings, and we stopped her at that point. What about immunizations? While you were talking, I was thinking of a bill last session, for example, and I don't know what happened to it. It had to do with hepatitis A, and I was wondering what happened to that, and so on and so forth. I'm not a doctor. Maybe Dr. Representative whatever Bates can tell me. I just don't remember what happened to the bill.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, you're correct. There was a bill about hepatitis A and pneumococcal, as I recall. That bill is still active. The issue with that is the funding. In order to assure that hepatitis A is covered under our school immunization law, we have to assure that there is funding available that all children could get that vaccine. At this particular point in time, we do not have enough resources to fund all of those kids that would need hepatitis A, because it's not all children would qualify for the Vaccines for Children's program. So it is an open issue, and it's still an issue. And, yes, immunizations would be one of those population services within our pyramid.
Follow-up. As I remember the issue from last time, it seemed to me that you could actually do a combination vaccine that would – and, again, back to the doctor. He's the one that would know that could actually – deliver some health services to more kids and not cost so much money. I hate walking around here because I don't know enough about it, and I'm working from memory. I mean, I've just heard it said that sometimes
there is an
hepatitis A. There
isn't, but I think. Go ahead.
No, you go on.
The AB vaccine is available now in this country. It wasn't 2 years ago.
Okay.
But it's primarily, if my memory serves me correctly, for adults or near adults. It's not really set up for children, for them to have the B vaccine and AB combination. So we're still giving them the B vaccine. Mm-hmm. That's the one that's the deadly one. And trying to prevent the B vaccine, you know, hepatitis B when they're adults or at risk. And there's actually a chance that we can make hepatitis B go the direction of smallpox and eliminate it, because we're the only host for it. Hepatitis A is a little more difficult, but that vaccine's available but expensive yet, and that's the problem.
And
follow up?
Yeah, I don't know who I'm asking this question to. Maybe the expert over here.
What am I doing?
But my question is, what's the threat to the public? And I mean, we're talking about public health here, and I just didn't want us to say, yeah, there's A, but we don't have money to do it, and later pay some price in society and in the health of our citizenry. That's all. And if there was some way to do the combination, I just wanted to explore that.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, there is a concern about hepatitis A in Oregon, because when you look at incidence of hepatitis A, Oregon has had a higher incidence. Currently, we have been fairly free of one of those outbreaks or an epidemic type of occurrence. We're in our sixth year, but makes us nervous when that happens. So our concern is, yes, we would like all children to be immunized for hepatitis A, but again, it's a resource issue. Continuing along on the pyramid, other population-based services that our office is involved in is fluoridation of water, community water supplies, and I would like to talk about that a little bit later. Another one is breastfeeding promotion, and giving the committee's interest on obesity prevention, nutrition, and exercise, breastfeeding is one of the best preventive measures we have against obesity, as well as numerous other kinds of things. Breastfeeding is one of the things that people can do to promote good nutrition as well as prevent obesity. So breastfeeding promotion, breastfeeding support is another population-based service that we provide through our office. Along the same lines would be folic acid education. Many people have recognized folic acid is important for good outcomes of pregnancy, but what they don't recognize is that folic acid needs to be taken prior to pregnancy. So those are the types of educational programs that we would be providing under population-based service. Another one would be fetal alcohol syndrome prevention, increasing public's awareness about that, increasing public's awareness about drinking during pregnancy. And last on the pyramid is the infrastructure building. And many times people have heard the terms infrastructure building, we need resources for infrastructure building, so what does that mean? Our activities within the Office of Family Health for infrastructure building would be working with our local communities and with states along the collaborative efforts in Senate Bill 555, or Partners for Children and Families, in the early childhood systems development, also working within data system development. Currently, we're working with the Department of Education, the Commission on Children and Families, the Oregon Health Sciences University, I can only think of CDRC,
and others.
There's so much order on a data system development for early childhood systems. The idea was to have a larger data system that would address larger issues and include mental health and alcohol and drug and Medicaid, but we've reduced it down to a smaller module because of financial aspects. So those are the types of things that we would be doing under the area of infrastructure building. Now I'd like to just focus on three major areas within the Office of Family Health. The first one being school-based health centers, which I know that you've all heard about. Those school-based health centers began in our state in about 1985. They started with four and then expanded to 44. This last session on House Bill 5100, those resources were eliminated from the state budget. We have some concerns in relationship to child health about that, because we know that of the $1.2 million that were given to those clinics, or the $2.3 million, excuse me, $1 million of those services went to uninsured students. Some of the research that we've done within school-based health centers has identified that two-thirds of those uninsured students would not get health care had we not had those resources available to them. Also, we have been able to utilize school-based health centers for other kinds of health promotion activities. Again, in the area of nutrition and physical activity, we've had walk-to-school days. Also, in one of the schools, when they were concerned about, quote, junk food in the cafeteria and with the kinds of pastries and things that students were eating instead of breakfast, the school-based health center staff worked with that school to allow yogurt and fruits and vegetables to be available so that they were able to change some of the nutrition practices within that school, which then increased the positive nutrition for those students. So the absence of those programs is of concern to us. We currently know that at least four clinics have closed. We do not know of the other 16, whether or not those will remain after this fiscal year.
Representative Smith. Thank you. So is the purpose of, I'm on page 442 and 443, is the purpose of this because parents aren't taking care of their children?
Representative Smith, no, the purpose of school-based health centers is really access. You have access to the students. Some of these students do not have access to health care, but by being present in their school setting, then they can access those school health services. So it's not that the parents deliberately don't want to care for their kids. Many of them just don't have the resources to do that.
Wait, follow up.
Certainly. In terms of resources, can you define what resources means?
Money. I'm sorry, Representative Smith. Many of these students are either do not have health insurance or do not have a financial resources to be able to pay for a health care visit.
Well, one last question, then I'll let this go. I'm looking down the list on 443. This morning at 6 a.m., I was up running with my three boys, actually walking and chasing them around. That didn't take any money. Why would we put money into promoting community-based preteen physical activity projects?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, because not all families are as fortunate as yours to be able to have that as a role model, and some of them do not, you know, do not engage in physical activity. In some situations, the family constellation may not allow for that, or that is not a value that that family has had. So we need to do the education so that individuals know about the importance of nutrition and physical activity.
Madam Chair?
Certainly.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Just a comment. I understand the interest in promoting effective families who take a responsibility and good care of their children. Even insured families who have good health care are often irresponsible about their children. Our goal here is not to replace the family. It is to assure that when children sit in the classroom, they're healthy and not starving so that they can learn. And the school-based health centers are a kind of safety net for kids who are neglected in some other way. That is, they don't have access to a medical home, they don't have insurance, or they don't have that kind of structure in their lives. And I just want to relate a very brief story, because these kinds of efforts began about 15 years ago in earnest. And we had a special program in the Portland area that I had an opportunity to be involved with. There was a small elementary school where the turnover rate in the school was about 55% per year. That is, more than half the students left the school every year. There's no continuity in education. One of the reasons was that the families didn't have access to services, and we, the county, in this case Clackamas, and the state teamed up to actually put services in the school. And the relocation rate dropped, the kids performed better, the kids were healthier, and those families stayed intact. So what we're trying to do is actually help families. And unfortunately, the way the budget is moving, and I think it's unavoidable, is we're going to see the uninsurance rate increase. These centers are not meant to replace the healthcare system. They won't provide a medical home for a child, but they will provide a backstop, because there are a lot of people who just don't have access to care and don't have the kind of responsive environment that enables them to get what they need. I hope I haven't mischaracterized the program, but these school-based health centers are a safety net. We have not come here asking for funding for the school-based health centers. This is not included in the governor's balanced budget, but we thought that you should understand some of what the implications are of having removed those supports from the budget. School-based health centers can make use of reimbursement, for example, from insurance and other sources of funds, some of which come from the schools themselves, and we have been partnering with them. We are hopeful that not all of the centers that receive state general fund support will close. We all think right. About half of them will.
Representative Bates.
Just a couple comments and a question, which you know, gave a nice segue into. Thank you, Dr. Yes. The school-based health centers are really a response to a huge change in our society. We now have a society in which quite often, if not most often, both parents work. We have a large number of single families. And we have a disparity of health care available to areas of ethnic and other minorities where you just can't get, as a kid, cannot easily quickly get to a doctor. And that's reality. Those things, three things are reality. What school-based health centers do is, number one, allow those children in those situations to have access to health care. And what I found in my community, where we have three or four of these, and they're located in the poorest areas of our area for the most part. There's some in other areas, but for the most part, the ones we see the most are the most active ones, or ones are the poorest areas. Those kids are seen there, and if they need a referral, then they have access to the rest of the healthcare system through the school-based centers. So they have a vital role for us as a safety net clinic, basically for those children. It's where the kids are, at least 9 months out of the year, hopefully. Nowadays, I'm not so sure about 9 months, but that's where hopefully they are. And so they have a really vital role for us. local communities have stepped up and helped fund those because of that. They don't see these as an intrusion into the family. They see these as a support to the families, and the ones I've worked with have been very supportive of families, not an intrusion. And, you know, they need to be watched for that reason, but we haven't seen a problem there. The question I have for you is something that the school-based centers have kind of been resistant to before. Because of reason of confidentiality and other reasons, they've not wanted to go into the billing process. You could potentially give them help in that way. Billing processes, those kids that have insurance, who have means of paying for this, FCHIP kids, kids on the Oregon Health Plan, those kids in the past have not been well captured as far as bringing funds to these clinics. And I think there's a movement away from that towards doing it now. And if you're involved in that, I'd like to know. And I'd like to know how kind of progress we're making in getting those dollars to go into those clinics, because they're doing, you know, real medical care there, and they should be compensated for it when we can.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, we have been working with each of the school-based health centers about individual billing. And prior to this last legislative session, we were also working with them to see what we might be able to do as far as administrative match in relationship to school-based health centers. We had done some research on that. We had speculated the amount of resources that that could bring in, but we stopped those activities when we did not know for sure whether we were going to be able to continue to fund school-based health centers. And currently, even though the 20 centers that we did fund from general funds, we only gave a little over $50,000 per site, and the average is about $170,000 that it takes to run a good school-based health center. So they, each community leveraged those dollars into more resources so that they could support that. So it was an investment from the community as well as from the state. We just wanted to highlight it because of our concern about child health.
And Madam Chair, Representative Bates, I want to thank you for a much clearer and more effective discussion of that than I could provide. I appreciate that.
Moving on, I'd just like to focus on two other areas. One is an area that we're very pleased that we've been able to do something in, and that's oral health, which is on page 4-44. Over the last 15 years or so, from our public health perspective, we've not been able to do much in the area of oral health, mostly because of limited funding. In fact, we only had a 0.5 FTE, which was working with schools on fluoride wash programs. But within the last year, we've been able to procure resources from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for fluoridation promotion within our community water supplies. Currently, Oregon has less than 30% of the water supplies are fluoridated, and we know that fluoridation is a very cost-effective public health program. For every dollar invested, it saves at least $38 in health care costs. So we have some resources to continue to work with communities on water fluoridation. We were also able to procure some funds from the Robert Wood Johnson for an innovative program on how to increase access to oral health by focusing on prevention. Our hypothesis is, or the concept that we're building on, is that if we can prevent oral health disease in pregnant women and in infants and children up to 24 months, then there will be greater access for those that need treatment because there will not be these individuals needing that service. So the Robert Wood Johnson has granted us resources to pilot this concept in three of our communities throughout the state. Then last, I just wanted to highlight our immunization program and our immunization registry. Our immunization registry in Oregon has received national recognition as one of the best registries in the nation. And our immunization registry goes by the term ALERT. It's in capital letters. It is not an acronym. It doesn't stand for anything other than to alert people to the importance of immunizations. Last year, we were able to track the impact of the concern about thimerosal on immunizations. As you recall, there was a concern about thimerosal being put in immunizations as a preservative and a concern of the accumulative effect that that would have on a newborn. And so until we were able to get thimerosal-free vaccine, we suspended encouraging hepatitis B shots in the hospital. We were able to track using our registry that that definitely did happen. The immunization rate went down dramatically. Then once we were able to get thimerosal-free hepatitis B vaccine again, we were able to see that the vaccine rate for those newborns did rise again. And in fact, the data from our registry has been used by the Centers for Disease Control to identify why registries are effective and how they can help you in tracking what's going on in your communities. Currently, our ALERT registry has over 15 million immunizations in it for over a million individuals. We have 83% of the private sector who provides immunization to children enrolled in that program, and we are able to assist them in being sure that their students are up to date on immunizations. We currently have two bills this legislative session that address needs within our ALERT program. One is House Bill 2244, which is a fee bill. We're asking permission to be able to charge fees for those who utilize the registry. Currently, our registry is funded by a public-private partnership. Some of the funds come from Medicaid, some from our Centers for Disease Control budget, and some from donations from hospitals and health plans. This would allow us to charge fees to those who do not participate in the ALERT funding, but utilize those resources. The last bill is House Bill 2153, and it would facilitate an interstate transfer of immunization records so that if an individual receives an immunization in Portland and then goes to live in Vancouver and then comes back to get some immunizations in Vancouver and then comes back to Portland, we'd be able to track that information for that student so that that individual did not have to have another immunization. The data tells us that 60 to 70% of kids do not complete their immunizations where they start their immunization, so it's important that we can be able to share information across our state since we have several border communities. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordy.
Unless I wasn't listening well and I was out of the room a couple of times, I don't think we talked about women's and reproductive health.
We didn't. I meant to mention that as one of the services within the pyramid. That is really one of our direct care services where we provide women's and reproductive services to low-income women, 185% of poverty or less.
Senator Gordon?
I'll pass, given the hour.
I have individuals who are having to go to another committee.
Yes.
We have these committees back-to-back these days, the Audit and Budget Committee Representative Westland chairs is convening at 3:00, so and two of those members are on this body. Do you have a question, Representative Smith?
Actually, more of a statement, Chair Winters. I almost think we as a committee should require the Department of Education and the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department and the Employment Department to be required to sit in here and listen to what we're hearing, because I sit on the Economic Development Ways and Means Subcommittee, and the message we hear there is very different from the message we hear here. And it would be very nice to have everyone hear the same message.
It may be, we started at this session, which was a first of having two of the committees, actually three of the committees, joined together because of the linkages. And the public safety and this committee, both from the policy as well as the ways and means, and I think that was good because each side began to learn what implications and impacts that are happening in the others. And I think you're correct that what you hear sometimes in those other committees, they don't get to hear from this committee where real faces and real lives have been affected. That's a good observation.
Madam Chair, if I may, for just a moment, we are about at the end of our session for today. We will come back with a description of how these early childhood programs work together and how they're financed and how those dollars flow through them so that you will have no unanswered questions about that. And I also heard a desire to look at some of the data about performance and outcome so that you can see. This is, if you look at back at, I think it's page 17 in our presentation, 2-17, WIC, the Women, Infants, and Children's Program, is about 30% of the public health budget, and the other programs in family health are another 30% of the budget. It's a large enterprise that's very expansive, and what Donalda and I thought would be helpful is if we could demonstrate that we're talking about the whole spectrum of public health, from population-based prevention all the way to actual services to individual families and children, a very important part of our public health program, and we want the committee to understand.
Well, I'm going to sound like a broken record, but the request for performance measures and the request for a specific outcomes is one that carries over from, I think, if everyone will check their budget notes from last session, everyone's budget was, that was noted in every budget, because it was the expectation coming into this session that we would have the information from the agencies that would tell us what those outcomes were. I mean, it's not enough anymore, and I said it last session, for us to talk in at a high level about programs without this body knowing whether those programs are successful or not. And so any of the other agencies that are listening, it is the expectation that you do come with your performance measures and you do tell us what the outcomes are by program. And it'll speed up this process, but it'll also do something else. It'll help us as we have to begin to prioritize the budgets. You know, it's not no mistake that we are going to have to sit here in this body with you to determine what we're going to be able to fund with general fund dollars and what we're not going to be able to fund with general fund dollars. So I think that the more you have the information available to us that validates that this body should be doing those programs, the better it is for all of us, really. But it is the expectation. I said I would carry on the prodding of the former the senator who was here on this committee, and that Senator Mayee. And I made that promise, and I'm going to keep that promise, that we will continue to ask for performance outcomes and not just these broad mission statements, but specifically, what have you done, who have we served, and has that service been appropriate, and have we seen some results? So that's Senator Gordon, because she's going to continue the Mayee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I want to say to Representative Smith how much I am enjoying serving with him. He has this great ability to observe how we could be and should be more holistic in our approaches to looking at these public policy issues. With that said, I feel that we have shortchanged the discussion around women's and reproductive health this afternoon. And there's a particular area that I'm concerned about, and it's the increase in violence against women. And I would ask you to come back either orally or in written form with what is it that you would have us know about the increase in violence against women in this state, and where and how are we falling short in the way in which we address this challenge as a public policy issue, but also in terms of dollars, resources that should follow and address the problem. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator, I would love to do that.
Thank you.
If there's no further questions, comments, Mr. Britton?
Madam Chair, I want to clarify for tomorrow, if that's all right with you. Do you want to finish up with the Office of Public Health Systems? Do you want to hear more from Ms. Dodson, or what's your pleasure?
And I'm going to give them time to get the information, because I think we asked for quite a bit today. And I would like to finish up public health and then move on to the next.
To the Office of Medical or Health Plans,
yes.
and so on. Okay. Barry, you're okay?
Madam Chair, I am okay, with that, and we will expedite the conclusion of the public health presentation and bring the Office of Medical Assistance Programs in to begin their presentation tomorrow.
Okay. We are adjourned.